From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Ladies and gentlemen, please, we're on the order of concurrences.
This bill deals with the 2.5 million Illinois residents who currently have no access to employer-sponsored retirement plans.
Senate Bill 1009 is the revenge porn bill, ladies and gentlemen.
This legislation will reinstate an eavesdropping bill.
Represents our attempts to impose a commercial ride-sharing act.
What this measure will do will make our experiment of November 4th 2014, when people were allowed to register and vote on Election Day, that will make that a permanent part of Illinois law.
This week has been overwhelming. Overwhelming the destruction we have done to the state of Illinois.
We have a responsibility to follow through with the referendum question that asked the voters whether or not we should raise the wage. And so I'm hoping, well, I know for sure that our governor is looking to call a special session for the House to return and take up the measure.
This session is no different than others. There have been successes and there have been a lack of success. We are prepared to adjourn sine die.
Sounds from the final week of the fall veto session. That was House Speaker Michael Madigan permanently adjourning the Illinois House for the 98th General Assembly. Before that, we heard State Senator Kim Lightford still pushing to raise the minimum wage even after the House had left town. We'll talk about that and more on this week's State Week in Review. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel this week, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey with WUIS and Illinois Issues, Amanda Venicky, WUIS and Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief, our guest this week, Doug Finke, who covers the state capitol for Gatehouse News, which includes the Springfield Journal Register and papers in Peoria, Galesburg, and Macomb, among others. Well, because a minimum wage did not get passed, some people kind of said, well, the legislature didn't really do anything. But when you come and look at some of the topics that they actually did accomplish, there were some things that maybe for those who watch a legislature that could emerge as important. They might be boring, but important, but fit that bill. And because they changed the eavesdropping or renewed the eavesdropping law, for instance, changed the election laws. And we'll get started with some of that with Doug Finke. Doug, as you look back on this fall veto session, what to you were highlights?
Well, I mean, the highlights were some of the things that they did not do. For example, the minimum wage. Passed the Senate. It's not going anywhere in the House. The House also basically put a stop to the bill to change the school funding formula. They want to spend more time on that. Once Bruce Rauner got elected governor, that put an end to any talk about doing a veto session or lame duck session extension of the income tax increase. So there are a number of at least high-profile issues going into the veto session that the media had written about and talked about that ended up not being addressed during the session. And now it's, for many of those, it's we're going to wait and see what a new General Assembly does with any of them.
I mean, the thing is that just because the General Assembly doesn't do something, I don't know if that should be considered a failure. For some people that don't want a minimum wage increase, they're not dealing with it is a victory. But I think you can put it in the category of failure in a sense in that there wasn't even a vote. And so it's not as if there was an up-down and one side won, one side lost. It's just remaining out there. And in part, a lot of legislators say that's because of the action that Chicago took on Monday before the General Assembly had actually come into session to raise its minimum wage. But kind of the big failure there, you look at the state budget and the situation. Obviously, the next fiscal year, and Bruce Rauner had said, hey, don't do anything big. But this current General Assembly passed a budget that is not complete for this current fiscal year. And that didn't come up really at all. It's just sitting out there waiting. And given that the General Assembly is not expected to come back until mid-January, by then the income tax increase will already have begun to sunset and Illinois will already be on its way to a loss of revenue. So you're starting to get social service agencies, even some state agencies, for example, the Historic Preservation one, wondering what they are to do. So in that regard, I think you could categorize it as a failure because those are just unanswered questions.
You know, Amanda, I think you're right, and Doug, too, about a lot of the attention at this veto session. It was on, will there be a minimum wage? There had been, I mean, Bruce Rauner during the election was trying to stir talk that there would be this tax increase vote. I think that his election made that a foregone conclusion that that was not going to happen. Democrats are certainly not going to, you know, quote unquote, help him out by increasing the revenue he has to try and balance the budget for the rest of this year and in the future. But I do think that to Bill's point, there were a lot of fairly significant things that did kind of sneak through because we were all kind of, sneak through, we did notice them, but there's a lot of stuff that under other circumstances would have gotten a lot more attention. These individual retirement accounts that are going to be available for people who work at, you know, certain size companies and don't have access to retirement plan, now they will be forced, or the companies will be forced to offer retirement plans to people in Illinois. That's pretty big. This election law change, pretty big. There's a lot of stuff that they did do.
Well, let's get into the election law change.
Phil, could I make sure and interject one quick thing before we get to those things?
Go ahead, Amanda.
I think that the interesting part, though, and why the focus is on what didn't happen. Brian is right, and I mean, we should get to those because they are major policy changes. But what the expectation had been a lot of, well, what is the General Assembly going to sneak through while Governor Pat Quinn is still in office before a Republican takes over with Democratic supermajorities? And the fact that they aren't coming back, at least as of now, in January for any lame duck session, and the House Speaker has indicated that that isn't on his agenda, that's really significant. We saw a lot of action and Democrats using their supermajorities with things such as this election bill, but there was not a whole slew of, there was some favors that we can get to for the trial lawyers who are traditional allies of Democrats. At least that's how Republicans see it with a couple of bills, but there wasn't a ton of it, of this sort of action before Rauner takes over. And also, I think it's a matter of Governor Pat Quinn's legacy and why he is perhaps holding out hope. And there's this lingering question, as we heard in the opening from Senator Kim Lightford, of I hope he calls a special session before mid-January and before the inauguration to finish up this minimum wage, because that was supposed to be Governor Pat Quinn's legacy. And it perhaps points to why a lot of people did not recognize him as a quality governor. He wasn't able to, you know, twist those arms, nor did Democrats want to go out there and really give him one last favor, one last hurrah. He wasn't able to get that done.
Was he even around the Capitol in the final week?
He was here. He was in Springfield, although I did not visibly actually see him at all.
Saw his security guard,
saw his press folk.
Well, let's get to some of those issues quickly. The election laws have been changed. That's pending that the governor signs all these outright.
Right, that's a good point.
But the legislature has approved same-day election registration in Illinois, along with some ancillary changes around that issue.
Yeah, and so this was something that was done as a sort of a pilot program this year. You could show up on election day at a select number of sites in your jurisdiction and, you know, register to vote on a provisional basis. That did cause some problems in Chicago. We had people waiting apparently until 3 a.m. on Wednesday, the day after Election Day, in order to vote. This one goes even, this change that was enacted this week goes even further. It would say that you could show up in your own precinct and register to vote. There were a bunch of other changes in this legislation, as you said, assuming the governor signs it. And it's a fairly significant piece of legislation.
Another issue that came up, and you mentioned this when you were chatting, Brian, was that certain companies, pending it's signed into law as is, companies that employ people with more than 25 workers who don't provide some type of retirement plan, whether that be a 401k or, I guess, in some cases, a pension, would be forced to offer an IRA. They wouldn't have to chip in on that, but it would almost force a savings plan upon some workers in Illinois.
Yeah, this is State Senator Daniel Biss has been working on this for at least a year that I know of, could be longer. They estimate, he and his supporters estimate, that there could be as many as 2.5 million workers in Illinois, a lot of them very low-income workers who don't have access to a retirement plan. And this is part of this idea in social science we've heard about the nudge, right, where people will tend to do things that are in their short-term interest, like, you know, take all their money and spend it on things like rent and cars and food and stuff, and not save for the future, save for retirement. So this, the idea here is that employees at companies that have 25 or more workers that don't currently offer a retirement plan would be forced to offer this. Employees would be put in by default. They would have 3% of their pay go into this individual retirement account. As you said, the companies not only don't have to contribute, they're forbidden from contributing. The state doesn't contribute. The state's not on the line, but it does set up an investment vehicle for this to, you know, for this money to be invested. And then the idea is that employees could opt out if they want, but they're hoping that this will sort of nudge them into better preparing for their own retirement.
And Illinois would be the first state to do something. It's not that often that the Illinois legislature decides to become the first to take up some new laws. But this one strikes me as interesting and substantive, Charlie.
Yeah, it is a departure. And as you said, no other state does it. So I guess we're groundbreaking in this respect. But there is concern about people's retirement. And as Brian said, particularly folks at the lower end of the pay scale don't have the luxury of being able to sock money away in stocks and bonds and go out and buy companies and be an equity investor and all the rest of it. They're struggling just to put food on the table for their kids and to pay the rent. And this kind of mandatory withdrawal from your paycheck is intended to give a cushion for those folks as they reach retirement age. To go along with Social Security, because people forget that Social Security was not envisioned as being kind of like the sole source of retirement income. It was supposed to be a supplement to whatever you'd saved on your own. And in recent years, it's been much more difficult for people to save on their own. And so this is a step forward. The business community was kind of against it, as I gather, in part because they were concerned about costs associated with having to set up the additional deductions from the employee's paycheck. But I think Senator Biss and others argued that this would be a minimal expense. It's just, you know, you program your computer, you already take out money for Social Security, you already take out money for federal and state income taxes. This is just another little coding that you put in, and it automatically deducts money and goes into this retirement account.
Yeah, that was one of the objections.
Yeah, as I recall, during the debate, someone mentioned that like an overwhelming number of companies that would be affected by this actually used a payroll service to process their payrolls and deductions. So it's not like it would be a burden on the company itself. It would just be an extra deduction that would be handled by the company that already processes their paychecks. The other thing I think is going to be really interesting is to see how many people end up opting out of this. The way the law reads now, you are automatically in unless you choose to get out. I would suspect there are a fair number of people out there who are probably not paying attention to this and are going to be quite surprised when they're alerted that all of a sudden 3% of their paycheck is going to be put into a savings plan, no matter how good it may be for them. A large number of them may decide that that's not what they want to do.
And just as you said, they're not probably paying attention. I think that's part of why this was able to get through during the veto session and why there was all of this action on kind of these more side issues significant to certain populations and interest groups, but not this major change such as minimum wage or budget that gets all the rest of that attention, is because, you know, you don't know what's going to fly. And I believe the people who were against this change had kind of fallen asleep, thought it wasn't going to go anywhere, is what it seems to have happened. And that's why it was able to get through. Also, legislators are prone to doing this sort of thing. Remember, again, the lame duck session before in 2011 is when the income tax increase passed. Obviously, people are paying attention to it, but it's, you know, when legislators are on the way out, when they might be more free to take a couple of these more controversial votes, and when so much is going on, you can shove it through. It's another end of session, and when this sort of thing happens.
Amanda mentioned that the trial lawyers may have benefited from some lawmaking this past week. We'll talk about that just ahead on State Week.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, a public affairs magazine deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. The December issue is online at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Amanda Venicky, and Doug Finke of the State Journal Register and Gatehouse News. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Amanda, you mentioned the governor didn't really get any gifts from the legislature, but perhaps lobbying interest of attorneys got something. You want to talk about that?
That's the accusation, at least. Of course, you have legislators saying, who sponsored it, saying, oh, no, that's not what this is about. But we had a couple there, including one that would have the size of juries in civil trials and require jurors to be paid more. And then another which would extend, basically, you can phrase it as like the statute of limitations or something, where individuals who say that they have taken sick during construction projects because of asbestos and then later on got mesothelioma to be able to bring a lawsuit because of that. And so that, again, a favor to trial lawyers. That said, it was still scaled back. Originally, it would have been a whole broad range of really diseases or issues that you could go back in time and sue a company for if you came down with one of them. And instead, when there was a lot of backlash, it was narrowed down to just mesothelioma, really, because they say that you won't be able to even detect it until a decade out when the previous deadline had been.
Well, if you measure things by TV ads, it seems like mesothelioma, or how it ever is correctly pronounced, but that was my stab at it, it seems to be a profitable area for some nationwide trial attorney firms who go around and advertise state to state on class action suits. Seems like opening the window longer on that one will help victims of that, but it also will help an industry on that particular type of lawsuit.
Yeah, one of the lawyers who was urging this to be passed was testifying in a committee. He said there are only 2,600 cases of mesothelioma every year, and this is a certain type of cancer that is related to having work with asbestos. What the opponents will say is that they're very concerned about the architects, for example. The American Institute of Architects got up there and said that they're worried that some architect who helped design the Stratton Building, for example, which is a state office building right next door to the Capitol, and it has asbestos throughout it. Every time they go so much to change a light bulb, they have to put red tape up on the floor, and you have to vacate the offices in that area. So, you know, an architect
who... Well, we keep working away.
Well, we're dedicated in the press corps. But the architect who worked on that building, this architecture association says, could now be opened up to liability for somebody maybe who worked in there and, you know, claims they were exposed to this cancerous material.
The other thing you mentioned, Amanda, they're cutting the jury size. And again, this is all has to be signed by the governor, but cutting civil juries in half. Is the assumption there that that makes it easier to win a case when maybe if you're suing somebody over an accident that you only have to convince six people in a civil case that your point of view is the one they should take?
I think that issue was raised during the debate that obviously if you only have to convince six people rather than 12, the job becomes a lot easier. I don't know if there's any real solid evidence to prove that point, but I believe
we'll have to take it to court to find out.
I believe that issue was raised during the debate by someone who was skeptical about the whole move.
Yeah, this is one of those things. I was trying to puzzle through this myself because I guess Illinois is one of only, I think, a dozen states that actually has a 12 person unanimous jury requirement in a civil case. So if you are on the other side, the business side, for example, and somebody is suing a company because they slipped and fell or something like that, you only have to convince one person to say no. And then they, you can end up with a hung jury, or maybe you would, they would not be able to get this person would not be able to get compensation. So you do reduce that. However, the attorney who was pushing this is a guy named Joe Power. He claims that his real interest here was increasing juror pay, and this does actually raise the amount of money jurors will get. In some parts of the state, I was hearing something like $4 an hour, I think, is what some jurors are making.
No,
he said
$4 a day.
$4 a day, Charlie. That's even worse. He told a story about he was working a trial once, and a juror came in and told the judge that his car had been repossessed because the trial was taking a few weeks, and he wasn't able to work his normal job, and he couldn't make his car payment. So he says that this is about, he wants to really increase juror pay. He thought he'd offer this, compromise, the idea of reducing jury sizes. I guess Indiana, Michigan—
To cut expenses.
Yeah, to cut expenses. I guess Indiana, Michigan, and the federal court system have all had six-person juries on civil trials for a long time. We should also add that this does not affect criminal cases where the 12-person trial by jury would continue.
But what makes it suspicious is just that it was, again, pushed through during this brief period. You see this legislation pop up. It hadn't gotten any attention during the regular General Assembly during the months that it met. And then in a matter of days, it gets pushed through and sent to the governor's desk.
It is amazing how that happens sometimes. An issue that, while reporters have written about it, probably hasn't picked up the attention of the public that much, is the state's eavesdropping law. Illinois has not had one for a little while because the state Supreme Court threw out the existing law, which essentially required that anybody being recorded, everybody had to know about it and have their consent. And that has now been changed. And can you outline, Doug or Amanda, the eavesdropping legislation that is now on the way to the governor?
So as you said, Bill, this was basically just trying to correct a problem because Illinois didn't have one. So anybody could be recording anyone. There are some, however, detractors who believe that this is flawed, that they didn't. Others say that it's a compromise. What I think is particularly notable about this is in the wake of all that has gone on in our neighboring state of Missouri and Ferguson, this does not address the question of police cameras and recordings. And so that has been left. This affects people like journalists. I now need to go back to, as I've always done, asking, were it to be signed into law at least, may I record this conversation? But the looming questions out there in terms of when you need to record police, which is really what had brought this question to the court's attention in the first place, remain out there.
Yeah, and this is a great point you just made, Amanda, because what prompted this is the Illinois Supreme Court struck down the state's eavesdropping law because, for example, it was, I believe, a felony to record a police officer in the conduct of their duty. Now, law enforcement will tell you that they don't want to see gang members, out there filming potential victims and targets as police go around knocking on doors, investigating a homicide, for example. They don't want, other criminals out there filming them, filming potential witnesses. But, obviously we have seen enough in this country in the past two weeks alone about, people in the public filming government officials doing their jobs. And sometimes, you can uncover potential misconduct that way. So, this law that goes back to the governor basically restores quite a bit of what was in the previous eavesdropping law. They've tweaked it just enough that they hope that if it does get challenged in the Illinois Supreme Court again, that they'll be able to squeak through.
Another measure brought up, a quick summary if you could give it to us, some regulation on the ride-sharing industry, which is known a little more among younger listeners.
Younger listeners and city dwellers, because that's where it's in effect. You have these ride-sharing companies such as Uber is really the big one that's known in Illinois and also nationally, where you can use your phone app to basically call somebody to come and pick you up, but they don't have to be an individual who is a licensed taxi driver. And so this got a lot of attention after the governor had vetoed it, and also incoming Governor Bruce Rauner had said no to regulations that were passed in the spring session. This is known as a compromise bill, and it gets to answer some questions in terms of what insurance companies need to what these ride-sharing companies need to have in terms of insurance to protect both the drivers and to the riders that they pick up. And Uber did go along with it. It does not go as far as the first measure had gotten to. The plan here and the thought, I think, is that now you will hopefully have or at least by the advocates of it, a governor sign it, and also Uber on board. They've hired a lot of people in the city of Chicago and have basically said, oh, we'll expand. We'll come maybe to Springfield, to Champaign, to Bloomington, these college towns, if you don't go too hard on us.
We'll take some time now, and we'll go to notes from the field. And Amanda, I'm actually going to pin you on one. I wanted you to talk about bobcats.
So, yes, another one of these measures that got through in the very final day of the meeting of the Illinois Senate is one that would establish a bobcat hunting season. The people who are proponents say that after Illinois lifted bobcats in 1999 from the threatened list of, you know, endangered species, that now their population is booming and you see cats all over the place. The Department of Natural Resources says they're in every state, in every county of the state. And so now hunters would be allowed to shoot these kitties. And that's something that environmentalists and opponents say is unnecessary, that there are no indications that bobcats have caused any destruction, and this is just a way to for hunters to get a trophy.
Doug Finke.
Lawmakers last week approved a resolution to name the State Museum building after Alan Dixon, the late politician, known fondly as Al the Pal in many quarters. We will now have another building in the Capitol complex named after an Illinois politician.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, in a little more than 2 months, Governor-elect Bruce Rauner will have to unveil his budget plan for the fiscal year that starts July 1st. And the House Democrats put out a calendar for the spring session, and it notes that the governor's budget address is scheduled for February 18th. Which just so happens to be Ash Wednesday.
And Brian Mackey.
Yeah, there was an interesting bit of news out of the world of labor this week. A couple of pieces of news, actually. Last week, apparently, the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, which is one of the few unions that's kind of thought of as growing, it's trying to unionize and successfully unionizing hotel workers and a lot more service economy people, as well as home healthcare workers, that apparently they reached some kind of agreement to remain neutral in the race for mayor of Chicago. And then, the mayor pushes through a big minimum wage hike in the city, and all of a sudden, one of the subgroups of this union decides to break ranks and gives a lot of money to Cook County Commissioner Jesus Garcia, who is going to be challenging Mayor Emanuel. So just a little bit potential union battle. They've been talking about revoking their charter. This comes on the same week that we learned that one of the only two dedicated newspaper labor beat reporters in the country has taken a buyout. Steve Greenhouse from the New York Times is not going to be working there at a time when we really need that kind of coverage.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. Special thanks to Doug Finke of Gatehouse Media for joining us. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, and you can search it out on iTunes or iTunes U for State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.